Good morning, and welcome to First Coast Connect. I'm Ann Schindler. Before we get rolling, here are three things you should know today. A Duval County police dog received a special protective vest as a result of a donation from a national nonprofit. The canine Maverick will wear the bullet and stab-proof vest, similar to dogs in other school districts around the country. Second, Jacksonville University announced plans to move its College of Law to a permanent space in the historic former Atlantic Bank building downtown. The $12.5 million project must still be approved by City Council. Finally, city leaders will vote Tuesday whether to acquire the site of a proposed liquor store, which was strenuously opposed by neighbors in the Brentwood community. The cost of the acquisition is expected to be $1.8 million. Today, we'll discuss legendary folk hero Gamble Rogers and the music festival he inspired, plus how you can support the meaningful work of nonprofits across the First Coast this Giving Tuesday. But first, it was a test of the local criminal justice system. Whether it passed or failed may depend on your perspective. Two Jacksonville men convicted of murder served 42 years in prison, one initially on death row, before being exonerated in early 2019. Their story drew national and even international attention at the time, and is now the subject of an extensive examination in the new book, Justice Pursued, The Exoneration of Nathan Myers and Clifford Williams. We're joined now by its author, Bruce Horovitz. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Anne. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. And to our listeners, do you think the criminal justice system is doing enough to prevent wrongful convictions? And who should be in charge of investigating claims of innocence? Give us a call at 549-2937 or email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook and Instagram pages or tag us on X at FCC On Air. So, Bruce, when and how did you first become aware of this case?
Well, I was aware of it because of a lot of the national attention and local attention that it received in the media. It was obviously a very high-profile case, and it immediately, it was just very interesting reading. And I ran into State Attorney Melissa Nelson one day at the courthouse, and we were talking about the case and decided to go ahead and dive into it to get the full perspective of what really happened.
And there are a lot of layers to this story. You were mentioning just a few minutes ago to me that there's, in every wrongful conviction reversal, there's an interesting story. But one thing that was particularly interesting about this case was that it was the first case pursued by this conviction integrity unit that was created by this current state attorney, Melissa Nelson. And it was the first of its kind in Florida.
Correct. Conviction integrity units are a new trend among prosecutors that are looking to look back at cases and correct wrongful convictions. And there was not one in Florida, but when Melissa got elected, it was one of her first priorities was to bring trust back into the system. And she created this conviction integrity unit, which was the first in Florida. And there are now, I think, four or five, but this was the first. And there were so many unique things about this particular case, because not only was it a conviction integrity unit that reviewed it, but this was not a case that was overturned because of new DNA evidence. There was no DNA in this. This was strictly a reinvestigation of the case. And the fact that it was in Jacksonville had a great interest to me, but it also touched into the larger issue of wrongful convictions in the United States and compensation for persons that have been wrongfully convicted, and raises a lot of issues in terms of the difference between a wrongful conviction and factually innocent. So, as you said, there were a lot of layers to this case that made this, I think, a fascinating story.
And conviction integrity units like the one that was created here are not without controversy, even within the office of the prosecutor. Not everybody believes that that's the role or an appropriate investment of time and resources.
That's correct. But there is a long history of prosecutors looking back at cases to see if there were wrongful convictions. But it does generate some controversy within the departments, because prosecutors feel like that they don't want somebody looking over their shoulder for a case that was tried 40-something years ago. However, I think it is a trend that is growing. There have been a number of conviction integrity units that have come on board in the last 10 years, and they are having an impact. And what they are providing is another means and another outlet for those that have been wrongfully convicted to have as a resource. It's generally been reserved for pro bono defense attorneys, groups like the Innocence Project, the Equal Justice Initiative. But for the first time, not the first time, but what this does, it enables the power of the state to get behind these cases and gives the resources of the state to look back at these. And so they are not without controversy, but prosecutors are not in the business of convicting people that are innocent. And so I think there is growing reception of the idea that, look, we're not just about convictions, but we have to also look at the fact that sometimes the system, for whatever reason, has, you know, doesn't always work perfectly.
So remind us of the broad outlines of this case. It involved a man named Nathan Myers and his uncle, Clifford Williams, and they were accused of a murder. It was in 1976?
1976. And it was a murder in downtown Jacksonville. Two women were shot. One was killed. One was wounded. The wounded individual, Nina Marshall, after being shot, made it over to University Hospital, where she identified the shooters as being Nathan Myers and Clifford Williams, who she knew. The area in town where this happened was an area of gang activity, drug activity, and she identified Clifford Williams and Nathan Myers as the shooters. However, the evidence in the case, the forensic evidence and the eyewitness or witnesses in the case had a different story to tell. And Nathan Myers and Clifford Williams say that they were at a party in a neighboring apartment with 30 or 40 other people when they heard shots. And all the people at that party all said that these two guys were at the party when the shots were heard. And the evidence inside the apartment where the shooting took place didn't really match up to Nina Marshall, who was the surviving victim's story, as to where the shots were fired from and how the shooting went down.
It didn't seem that that evidence got examined very thoroughly when the trial first occurred. And it's important to note that, you know, back then cases were handled somewhat differently. They were perhaps on a faster schedule, especially a death penalty case, which this was for Clifford Williams. The kind of the work that was done at the time was not maybe as deep as what was done later on by the Conviction Integrity Unit folks.
That's correct. These two individuals were tried within a couple of months of their arrest. The trial took 2 days. But what was really significant is the strategy used by the defense attorneys at the time. Back in the 1970s, there was a strategy where part of your defense, you could have the last word in front of the jury, but there was a catch to that. And the catch was, if you had the last word in front of the jury, you could not call any witnesses. So the way it generally works and the way it works now is that the prosecution gets the opening statement, the defense then has its statement, and then the prosecution gets the last word in the closing argument. But back then, the defense could get the last word in front of the jury, but they weren't allowed to call any witnesses. So even though there were 30 or 40 people who, in their depositions and in interviews with police, said that Clifford Williams and Nathan Myers were at this party when they all heard the shots, none of those witnesses were ever called, nor was any of the forensic evidence that indicated that the shooting really came from outside the apartment as opposed to inside was ever brought to the jury.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Bruce Horovitz. He's the author of a new book about a local case where two men were exonerated. It's called Justice Pursued, The Exoneration of Nathan Myers and Clifford Williams. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 549-2937 or email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also reach out to us on the social media platforms. So in talking to the people for this book, you talked to a lot of the players. I mean, you spoke to the state attorney. You spoke to Shelley Thibodeau, who runs the Conviction Integrity Unit. You spoke to the two men themselves, who had quite a story to tell, particularly Nathan Myers, who had worked while behind bars to bring this case to the Conviction Integrity Unit, had taken a polygraph, had worked to try to bring, to make this reversal happen. How did those conversations go, and how did you connect with them?
Well, it started with actually State Attorney Melissa Nelson speaking with them to see if they would be willing to talk about their story. And so I did spend some extensive time with Nathan and some time with Clifford talking about their story. And really, the story really hinged on the fact that they were in prison for more than four decades, languishing in prison with really no hope of any of ever getting out. And then there was an election where Melissa Nelson won the position of state attorney in the Fourth Judicial Circuit. And one of her first priorities was to create this conviction integrity unit. And when I say priorities, it sort of happened not by accident, but she did say something at a Florida Times Union meeting where somebody asked her, did she have an interest in it? And she had some preliminary discussions about forming such a unit. And she said, yes, there was an interest on her part. And then the next thing you know, there were headlines that she intended to create this conviction integrity unit, which would have been the first in Florida. And she felt an obligation to pursue that. And so her election and statement that she wanted to create this conviction integrity unit caught the eye of one of Nathan Meyer's friends who was also in prison. And it started the whole chain of reaction where he sent a petition in to have his case reviewed by this unit. And it became the first case that they reviewed.
And we should say that, you know, Clifford Williams is not doing great these days. He had an undiagnosed prostate cancer while in prison. And so upon his release, he kind of immediately had to have some very aggressive treatment done. And he's, you know, an older gentleman. But your book digs into the history of both of these men. And it comes up later when the question of compensation is raised. They had a criminal history. Talk about that and how you chose to explore it. I learned a lot reading this book that I didn't know about that component.
Well, both Clifford Williams, more so Clifford Williams than Nathan Meyers, were involved in gang and drug activity back in the 1970s. And Clifford Williams actually had two prior felony convictions. And although they maintained their innocence in this case, they did have a criminal background. Florida has something called the Clean Hands Statute, which means that someone who is convicted of wrongful conviction is entitled to compensation unless they have a prior felony conviction. Well, in this case, Clifford Williams had two prior felony convictions. Nathan Meyers had none. So even though they were originally convicted of the same crime but exonerated, Nathan Meyers was entitled to compensation and Clifford Williams wasn't. And the statute provides $50,000 a year for every year of incarceration. But Clifford Williams wasn't legally entitled to it because of his prior felony convictions. Now, the Florida legislature is not bound by that. They could create a special compensation bill that would allow him to collect the money. And so they did so in the Florida legislature, and it received tremendous bipartisan support on both sides of the aisle. And Clifford Williams was awarded a little more than $2.5 million for his years in prison. Nathan Meyers, who had no prior conviction, it was assumed that he would automatically get the money, but there was a little hiccup with that, too, when the Attorney General's office in Florida said that Nathan Meyers, while he may have been wrongfully convicted or there may have been issues with his conviction, had not proved his innocence. And the Attorney General's office originally denied that request for compensation, but then the same office overruled themselves and said that was beyond their jurisdiction to question his innocence or guilt in this. So both men were compensated. Florida is still battling with this Clean Hands Act, though, and it's still an issue that the legislature deals with on a regular basis.
I recall being in Tallahassee when that bill was passed for Clifford Williams, and it was a big day. It was standing ovation for him, very bipartisan support. Not a lot of mention of his criminal history at the time, but a lot of support for seeing that he was compensated. And so he received, I think, a little over $2 million.
Correct.
And they provided that rather than that be, you know, distributed as an annuity, that he would actually get it since he was old, you know, and perhaps wouldn't be around for the eventual payout of a.
Yeah, it's in a trust, and the trust, there's some trustees that help oversee the distribution of those funds. So it's in good hands.
And that represents kind of a per year amount that you get for being wrongfully convicted?
Yes. It's $50,000 a year is the way the statute reads.
So you talk about the question of, you know, actual innocence versus not guilt. And Shelley Thibodeau, who runs the unit had an interesting quote in your book. She says, what is the threshold of innocence? The threshold of guilt is beyond a reasonable doubt. But it's an interesting question. In this case, do you believe that innocence was established?
You know, it's really hard to say. My goal in the book was to present the story as it happened. There are those who are convinced, and the courts upheld the findings of the Conviction Integrity Unit. There certainly was new evidence that was not made available to the jury that would indicate that these two individuals probably would not have been convicted had the jury had this information. And certainly in today's court system, that strategy of the last word strategy is not available. And so, you know, my guess is that they would not have been convicted. And nobody really knows what happened except those that were involved, but there was a preponderance of evidence that indicated that these two individuals were at the party when the shots were heard. There was evidence that the shots came from outside the apartment window, as opposed to inside, which is where the victim, Nina Marshall, indicated that the shots were fired from. There was a lot of evidence that showed that those shots came from outside. And the credit to the Conviction Integrity Review Unit, they recreated the crime scenes. They did all kinds of testing. They had shots fired from outside and then inside to see what kind of sound it generated and whether people look up, doors down, would have been able to hear the shots if they had been fired inside as opposed to outside. So there was a lot of testing done. And so I think that there's a preponderance of evidence that indicates that these two individuals were not involved in this shooting. There was also someone who allegedly confessed to the shooting years later. So I think this is all stuff that the jury was not made aware of. And I think it's pretty clear that in terms of their conviction, that you could say that this conviction definitely had flaws.
But there's not really a satisfying answer, is there, as to why the victim, one of the two shooting victims, would have misidentified two people and also misstated where they were, where the shooting occurred. She claimed that they were standing at the foot of her bed, and the ballistics and all the other evidence showed that was not possible. That was not where the shots came from. They came from outside the window, or fairly well established. But there really isn't a good explanation as to why she would have misidentified them, people she knew.
That's correct. And she was a drug addict, and she admitted to being on drugs at the time, and there was a history between them. So there are a lot of theories as to maybe this is what she thought happened. There are theories that, you know, maybe there was some revenge that she wanted, but there's no real hard evidence as to why she said what she said. But she never wavered. Her story was fairly inconsistent of what happened during the shooting, but she never wavered from her contention that these were the two shooters. But again, she indicated that the shots came from inside, and most of the evidence seemed to indicate that the shots came from outside. And so her story did not really match up with what a lot of the forensics seemed to indicate.
One of the interesting things about this case that you talk about is the fact that a very well-known defense attorney here in town, Hank Cox, helped this current state attorney get elected, was kind of a big part of that. And he helped and pushed for a conviction integrity review unit to be established. It had very, strong beliefs that was a necessary thing. And yet the first case that's brought by the unit for a reversal was his case when he worked with the prosecution many years earlier. You talked to him for this book. How does he reflect on that now?
First of all, he was very candid about it, had no problem speaking about it. And he was surprised when Melissa Nelson showed up at his office one day and said, "Do you recall the name Boonie Williams?" And of course, Hank knew every detail of the case and reported every detail. And then Melissa said, "Well, we've been looking at that case and we think they may be innocent." And Hank did not throw any roadblocks in. He said, "You know, if that's the case, I'll live with it." But he maintained that he never would have prosecuted them had he felt like that they were innocent. And I think he still holds that belief today. I think he's commented that he understands that the conviction as it happened back in 1976, would probably not hold up today. But that's not the same thing as saying that they were factually innocent. So, but Hank was very candid in his understanding of the story. And also, I think he believes strongly in the conviction integrity unit process. He was one of the catalysts to make this happen in Jacksonville. So it was a very awkward situation, sort of ironic, but I think that, you know, Hank played a major role in not only helping elect Melissa, but also in the creation of this unit.
There was a long memory in the criminal justice community, and it was controversial for a lot of people, this reversal, not least our former mayor in Jacksonville, John Delaney, who was himself a former prosecutor under Ed Austin and remembered Boonie Williams and his reputation. And he wrote a long letter to the Florida Times Union after this conviction reversal saying it was flawed, that it should not have happened.
That's correct. It was a very long op-ed piece, and it was countered a week later by Bill White, who was the former public defender who's actually sat on the audit committee that reviewed the conviction integrity unit's report. And, you know, Bill White took the other side and said that the evidence was overwhelming, that these two were most likely innocent.
I'm going to take a call now. I believe we've got Tracy Williams Magwood on the line. Good morning, Miss Tracy. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for asking, ma'am, and yourself.
Very well. And you're Clifford Williams' daughter. You were a child when he was convicted. Tell us a little bit about your memories of that time.
I was 4 years old, and my dad was convicted and sentenced to death. So most of my childhood was spent in Rayford, Florida. I was up in it was a very secured area. I was raised by my grandparents, which was his mother and father, until their death. And holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, were spent there in Rayford. Grew up there on death row. And I say grew up on death row because that's where he spent most of my childhood. The death of John Spinkley, Ted Bundy, all of them were also affiliated in that same facility. So growing up there with my dad, having to visit him there, it was a long process. So when he got exonerated, along with my cousin Nate, it was a blessing.
Thank you, Tracy. Bruce Horvitz, this obviously is the kind of thing that doesn't just impact people who are behind bars, but obviously ripples through families. And as Tracy's recounting, being a four-year-old visiting her father on death row, it's just kind of a devastating impact to consider.
There's no way to put into words what it means to be in prison for as long as these two men were. They missed out on most of their lives. Nathan was barely 18 years old when he was arrested. He missed out on his entire life. He missed out on the death of his family members, his immediate family members, celebrations of family members. Clifford spent 5 years on death row and spent the rest of his life in prison until this exoneration. And had it not been for the Conviction Integrity Review Unit, it's most likely that both of these men would have passed away in prison. So there's no way to put in words or perspective, 1 year, 2 years wrongfully convicted is powerful. But to think that they spent more than four decades in prison, which was one of the motivating factors, I know, for the Conviction Integrity Review Unit, once they had a belief that this was a wrongful conviction, they saw a sense of urgency of getting these two men out because of the amount of time that they spent in prison. There's no way that you can put into words what they must have missed out on in their lives.
And their children, too. I know that Tracy's mother, she's previously told me, died in childbirth. And so
correct.
Clifford Williams was her only nuclear family.
That's correct.
Member that to raise her.
And what a blessing to have them out.
Yes. So has writing this book changed you? What about what you learned will stay with you?
Well, I have a great respect for the criminal justice system. That's always did, but the fact that they are going back and looking at cases like this is, I think, a wonderful thing. The thing that really opened my eyes up is that the number of wrongful convictions that there are. You read about exonerations all the time. You hear about them on the news. And there are people in jail who are wrongfully convicted. And so the fact that there is now a, not so much a movement, but an emphasis within prosecution offices to go back and look at these through conviction integrity review units, I think is a really good thing. But the criminal justice system continues to perform. It's the best system in the world. And I think that this review process is only going to make it better.
Tracy, if you're still there, can you just tell us about how the conviction reversal process impacted you emotionally and personally?
For years, I prayed, and for years, I believed that God would work a miracle. My dad, not only was he missed my graduation from high school, graduation from college, graduation for the birth of his first grandson, his granddaughters who also had to visit him and meet him behind those prison bars. The exoneration for me was a miracle, nothing less than a miracle. I got to, on my 48th birthday, have my first dance with my father, the dance that I didn't get at my wedding, the dance that I did not get at my graduation celebration from undergrad or graduate school. So it was a great opportunity. And my youngest daughter, I remember her asking him, Granddaddy, did you do this? And he said, no, baby. She said, I'm going to go to college and become a lawyer so I can get you out. And I remember State Attorney Melissa Nelson saying to her on that day of his exoneration that I know you had the desire to get him out, but we got him out for you. And so I'm ever grateful. And I heard you speak about State Attorney Cox. I'm sorry, he was State Attorney Cox at that time. It was a situation recently that I found myself and with my son, and he was the greatest advocate for my son. And it is because of him that my son was able to have his freedom. So it's strange because the very person that was the prosecutor became the greatest advocate for my family at the time I needed.
Tracy, thank you so much for sharing your story this morning. You were going to say...
Yeah, I just wanted to add that Tracy gave some very powerful personal testimony before the legislature, and it goes to the personal toll that this case took on the families. And as far as Hank's involvement with her son, again, it speaks to the criminal justice system and the beauty of how it works. And so there's a lot of good that came out of this story. There will be controversy about conviction integrity units in the future, but we can say that this really was a success story in many, many ways.
Well, it's a fascinating exploration in your book, Justice Pursued. Bruce Horovitz, thank you so much for joining us this segment.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be right back with a festival honoring musical legend and legendary raconteur Gamble Rogers.
Lies.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by Jim Carrick, president of Gamble Rogers Music Festival, who is playing a little guitar there of Gamble Rogers. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, I'm going to scooch a little closer. And welcome back to our guest, Bruce Horovitz, who, in addition to writing the book that we just discussed, Justice Pursued, is also the author of a book about Gamble Rogers, and we couldn't resist asking him to join this conversation as well. So thanks for being here this segment as well, Bruce.
I'm glad to stick around to talk about Gamble.
Perfect.
So he's a folk musician who's become a folk legend, both for his inimitable style and his heroic death. Before he died in 1991, Gamble Rogers had a 30-year career as one of the best-known folk musicians in the South and also a well-known voice to faithful NPR listeners. If you ever attended a Gamble Rogers Folk Festival or possibly had a chance to see Gamble Rogers perform, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 549-2937. Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or message us on Facebook or Instagram. Tag us on X at FCC on air. So I'm going to start with you now, Jim, if I can. When did the festival start and why was it formed around Gamble Rogers?
Well, when he died in that terrible way, he left us all in mourning for a long, long time in St. Augustine and just created a vacuum. And so when the dust finally settled, that festival was born out of that vacuum.
And so who is Gamble Rogers?
Who is? He was an incredible person as well as being a wonderful musician. Difficult to describe in many ways other than he possessed a certain type of charisma that's very rare. In other words, he could walk into a room and change things simply by being in the room. He didn't necessarily have to play or speak to do that, but people would be drawn to him. I experienced that one other time in my life when I was in the Exit Inn in Nashville one time, and the room changed. You know how you can feel that? You know how the hair goes up on the back of your neck sometimes when you know something's going on? Well, Johnny Cash just simply walked into the room. So he had that same sort of charisma. But looks like people would be drawn to him. They'd want to talk to him, and he was very generous with his time. He was a star with us a long time before he went out in that surf that day.
So let's touch on that. He had a well-lived life and a very tragic death. He was trying to rescue someone. Tell us a little bit about what occurred.
I'd like to talk more about other days than that one, but he was there camping with his wife. I had been at his house the day before and helped him actually load the van to get ready for that camping trip. They were down in Flagler Beach, and a little girl came up and was crying out for help for her father who was stuck in the surf. And it was a Northeaster. The surf was raging. No one should have been in it to start with. But a little background, Gamble had a childhood affliction that caused his spine to fuse. And he couldn't turn his head. He couldn't barely lift his arms above his head. Yet when he was called upon for help and there was no one else, his honor and conviction would allow him to do nothing else but try. And I'm not sure that I would have or how many of us would have, but he could not refuse.
I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I can see it's still an emotional thing for you.
For all of us, yeah.
Bruce, how did you learn about Gamble Rogers, and what prompted you to want to write a book about him?
Well, we were at Crescent Beach one day, and a gentleman approached me that I had known for some time. He produced a Polaroid photograph from the late 1940s of two babies on a blanket. And he said, do you know who these two people are? And I said, no. He says, that's me and Gamble Rogers. Well, it turned out that this gentleman, Bruce McEwen, who was eventually a Florida state legislator, grew up with Grant Gamble and was Gamble's closest friend. And he started telling me the story, and I went immediately to start researching more about this person. I went to the library. I went to the internet, and I saw that there had been very little written about this interesting man. So one by one, Bruce McEwen, who has since passed away, started introducing me to people like Jim Carrick and others who were in Gamble's circle. And it was clear to me that this was a story that needed to be told. And I'm really glad that we did it, because it really was, people need to know about Gamble. They need to know about his life, his contributions, his music, and the kind of person that he was.
So one of the things that Gamble Rogers was known for was his storytelling with his music. And he created this entire fictional community in Ocklawaha County, which is a place that doesn't exist, and a cast of characters that included Agamemnon Jones and Miss Eula Singletary. But it's hard to talk about Gamble without playing a little bit of his performance to get an idea of really kind of how he carried himself and what his delivery was. So let's hear a little bit of Gamble performing live.
If you want to buy chickens in Ocklawaha County, there's one place to go, and that's Arundel's Purina store on the square in Snipes Ford. And chickens ain't all you can get at Arundel's. You can get philosophy. Yeah, just go around the corner of the building to the loading ramp, which fronts the city square, for it is here upon this humble proscenium that there has gathered time out of mind a distinguished circle of rusticated sages and philosophers who, through the assiduous cultivation of dialectic and discourse and the subtle implementation of aphorism and epigram, have put in place a philosophy of existence posited on one dazzlingly simple revelation. Life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. Now, when I was just a little boy, just a kid, my dear mother would say to me, "Son, don't be hanging around downtown in front of that loading ramp listening to those old men talk that talk." "Why not, Mother?" I said. "Because you haven't got the judgment," was her reply. "Well, how do I get judgment, Mother?" I said. She said, "Judgment is not the kind of thing you just go out and get. Judgment is a thing conferred upon you by experience." "What's experience?" I said. "Never mind," came the reply. I went down to the loading ramp and I confronted those philosophers. I said, "Hey, what's experience?" They hollered back. They said, "Experience is what you get when you didn't get what you really wanted." After that, I never gave a flip about judgment.
Jim Carrick, what is it about Gamble Rogers that was so appealing, that connected with audiences so well?
Well, he would just simply blow you away with his incredible guitar work, and at the same time telling you a story at lightning speed and throwing words at you that you just never heard before. And his timing was impeccable, comedic timing, that is. And because he could tell an old, worn-out joke that we had heard 1,000 times and still split your sides laughing and want to hear it again. So, it was an amazing time.
He's been called Mark Twain with a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
He's performed on The Tonight Show. He was on the Ed Sullivan Show. He was a regular contributor to National Public Radio. So he had quite a public profile, Bruce, before his death.
Yeah, he did. He never really sought the limelight. But one of my favorite Gamble quotes was that somebody once asked him in a radio interview, "You know, do you consider yourself a musician, songwriter, a humorist? What do you consider yourself to really be, a humanitarian?" And Gamble looked straight at him and said, "I ain't nothing but a whiskey salesman." He says, the more I play, the more whiskey they drink. And that was his sort of humble way of kind of defining who he was. One of my other favorite quotes while Jim is here in the book is Jim Carrick, I think, pretty much nailed it when he said that everybody wanted to play guitar like Gamble, because he was an amazing guitar player. So he said everybody wanted to play guitar like Gamble, but more than that, everyone wanted to be like Gamble. And that really speaks to the legacy that this man left. He did so many things that people never knew about. Charity things, taking care of people, taking people under his wing. There was never a stranger in Gamble Rogers' life. If you met him the first time, it was like he knew you his whole life. And I had the fortune of writing this book without ever meeting Gamble Rogers or ever seeing Gamble Rogers perform. But based on all the people I met and the interviews that we did and the atmosphere around this man, I really felt like I got to know him. in a way that I was really privileged to be able to learn about.
And people obviously very willing to share those stories and their memories.
I could write three sequels to the book that I wrote once it came out. Oh, you didn't tell this story. Or, oh, I can give you a story about Gamble. At some point you had to stop, but it could go on and on and on.
Right. Well, I've said this quite a few times, especially recently doing things like this, but and I'll probably say it some more as the festival gets a little closer, but the key thing about our relationship with Gamble was that he, yes, taught us to be better musicians. He was very giving of his time. Sometimes he would teach me things on the guitar over the telephone. He would call from the road, and we'd go back over something we had worked on while he was home. And but more than that, by just our association with him and his example, he taught us to be better human beings.
So the 28th annual Gamble Rogers Folk Festival is April 12th and 14th at the St. Johns County Fairgrounds. But there are a couple things happening right now. There's some early bird tickets that are on sale right now until December 31st. And there's also a deadline for the youth stage. You're accepting submissions, I believe, until December 22nd.
That's correct. We do have a youth stage. It is now known as the Young Folk Stage, which we like it better. This is put together by our board member, Don Cooper, with help from Tommy Bledsoe and Gamble's daughter, Lolly Rogers. We invite young musicians to apply and come and have a professional experience on stage. It is part of our main mission is to get Gamble's legacy and music out into the community. If I may continue, there's one other part.
Just very briefly.
We do have a concert series that ties in with our school workshops where musicians traveling through town, nationally known musicians, go out to St. Augustine High School and actually put on a workshop for the students there.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for being here. You can find out more information at the Gamble Rogers website about the festival. Bruce Horvitz, thank you for joining us for a second segment. Jim Carrick, thank you so much for being here and playing guitar. Maybe we'll hear a little bit more.
Jacksonville Symphony welcomes world-class pianist Joyce Yang in a performance featuring Barber's Piano Concerto and Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. December 1st and 2nd. Visit jacksymphony.org.
Humana, dedicated to offering whole person health and wellness through a health plan and healthcare through Island Doctors, a provider in Humana's network. Committed to putting patients at the center of what they do. Learn more at healththatcares.com.
Today is Giving Tuesday. It's a day to give back to the organizations you value and feel good about. But why have that good feeling once a year when you can have it every month? Consider giving WJCT News 89.9 just $5 or $10 a month. You'll make a big difference every day and get the good feeling of Giving Tuesday every month. Call 353-9528 or go to wjct.org/radio. Thanks.
Hi, join me, Ira Flato, at the WJCT Studios for an evening of enlightening and engaging conversation with WJCT's President and CEO, David McGowan. That's on Tuesday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. For tickets and additional information, go to wjct.org/events. I look forward to seeing you there.
What do we know about America's child care cliff? Pandemic funding to help young families ended in September. Earlier estimates suggested more than 3 million children could lose their daycare spots as roughly tens of thousands of programs shuttered. We look at how the picture varies across the country and share your stories too. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. Today is Giving Tuesday, and here with more is Mari Kuraishi, president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund. Hi, Mari.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. So for those who are unfamiliar with the organization, what is the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund?
The Jesse Ball DuPont Fund is a private foundation based here in Jacksonville, founded by Jesse Ball DuPont, the third wife of Alfred I. DuPont and sister to Ed Ball, for those of you who are more familiar with Ed.
And for those who are not familiar with you, you're a bit of a superstar in the world of nonprofit fundraising. You started an organization called Global Giving. Tell me a little bit about that and what the mission is and how successful it's been.
Sure. So Global Giving is one of the first global crowdfunding platforms. We started back when crowdfunding was not a thing. And it has grown over the years into a platform that delivers over, you know, last year it was over $100 million to projects in all over the world in 175 different countries. And we were really trying to get money to those people who are doing the work on the ground and may not have the brand name to get in front of people. So we're very happy with how Global Giving has progressed.
And you earned a lot of accolades for that. But you left the organization to as a standalone, kind of on its own, managed successfully still, and came to do work with the Jesse Fund. Why did you make that decision?
Well, you know, you have to let your babies go, right? So that was it was the right time for me to let Global Giving grow up and stand on its own two legs. And the opportunity here to make a difference. I mean, it's great doing work in 175 different countries, but you don't actually get to see it. And the opportunity to come down here and work for the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and actually see the needle move was really attractive.
So let's talk about how the fund contributes to the Giving Tuesday movement. This is Giving Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is to emphasize, as opposed to the Black Fridays and the Cyber Mondays, that this is really a chance to give to the charitable community and the nonprofit world.
That's correct. I mean, Thanksgiving is a day of gratitude. And so I think Giving Tuesday following on the heels of Thanksgiving is perfectly apt. And Americans are incredibly generous. On the whole, Americans are more generous than many other different cultures. And it's partly got to do with the idea that we look out for each other. And so bringing this all together in one day, and increasingly this movement is global, is really amazing. If you look at your social media feed today, you will see so much giving and so much gratitude and so many acts of kindness. It just makes you feel great.
And while the spending on some of those other days has been record-setting, I think that they said that perhaps the highest, you know, revenues for a Cyber Monday. Does that correspond at all? Does that correlate to people's generosity, their ability to spend, their sense of how the economy is going?
It does. And Giving Tuesday itself has grown year over year. Last year, there were $3.1 billion given away on Giving Tuesday. And that was a 15% increase over the previous year. So I'm just really excited to see what 2023 brings. We'll find out tomorrow.
One of the things that has been researched recently is kind of interesting is the benefits of altruism, and not just sort of psychological benefits, but actual health benefits that can result in fewer depressive symptoms. It can have, you know, reported higher psychological benefits, life satisfaction. Talk a little bit about, you know, what giving gives back to the person who's doing the giving.
Yeah, it's incredible, right? You hear virtue is its own reward, and it really is, because when you give, you engage with other people. And when you engage with other people and think about their needs over your own, it turns out we get a health benefit and a psychological benefit there's been studies showing that if you want to show your employees how much you, the employer, appreciate them, give them a giving card rather than a Starbucks card. I mean,
what's a giving card?
A giving card is Donors Choose has it, Global Giving has it. They give you a credit on these platforms and say, go find a classroom you want to support. Go find a project somewhere in the world that you want to support. And it works just like a gift card, except what you're doing is giving money away.
That's a great concept. So how can First Coast residents make the biggest impact on Giving Tuesday?
I think it's worth finding out. We just did this research about generosity in Florida, and there are three different types of people. You're either an informal spontaneous giver or a reliable responder or an unengaged person. Figure out who you are, set a budget, and give in the way, in the style that fits with you. If you're a spontaneous person, let that spontaneity go to town. And if you're a reliable responder, go support the organizations you always support.
And we just like to say on this Giving Tuesday, don't forget to support your local public radio station that you come to support every day. You can go to wjct.org/Giving Tuesday. I'd like to thank you for being here today. Appreciate it, Mari. We'll see you back here tomorrow. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.